U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
It's primary day in New York as voters go to the polls in the race to be the Big Apple's next mayor. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. In a blue city like New York, the winner of the Democratic primary for mayor has a pretty straight path to the office itself. But this year's primary election, at least, appears to be pretty wide open. According to a New York Post poll last week, the man in the lead is Eric Adams. He's a former New York City police captain, and he's the first choice of about 21% of likely voters. Close behind at about 16% each are Maya Wiley and Catherine Garcia, two former members of the current administration run by Mayor Bill de Blasio. And then coming up with about 10% was Andrew Yang, who most people know mainly because he ran for president in 2020. And then there were a few candidates in the single digits. So, Bill, what do you make of this? What looks like a pretty fractured lineup, at least right now.
Right. Well, New York changed the system because what they're hoping to do, they have so many candidates, they're hoping to avoid the runoffs that they used to have. So they have this ranked voting where you also vote for second and third choices. The people who, I mean, crime is the biggest issue, according to all the polls. More than half of the voters in the polls say that crime is their biggest concern. And on that issue, there's a pretty clear divide. Eric Adams, a former police officer, who's actually been on the left, you know, in the New York cityscape for a long time. He's a former cop, and he's the only one really emphasizing law and order in the Democratic fold. So a vote for him is clearly a vote for law and order. And he seems to have a plurality. But one of the problems that he has is that though he's has a plural, I think it's 26% that would select him number one, he doesn't get many second or third place votes. And depending on how all the others shake up, that could hurt him.
Well, before we get there, let's say a word for people who don't live in and around New York City. I mean, maybe the shift on crime within the Democratic Party is one thing that makes this worth watching. But Kim, do you think that New York is a harbinger, or what are the stakes for people who are living elsewhere?
Yeah, if you don't live in New York, the reason you should care about this is because essentially there, but for the grace of God, goes the rest of the country. You know, this is a city that has now been run by Bill de Blasio for 8 miserable years. The only good news is that he's term limited and he can't stay any longer. And he inherited a city that had been managed pretty well for 20 years. You had Rudy Giuliani, who was very good on crime and public order. He made reforms on welfare and education, reduced regulation. And then you had Mike Bloomberg, who wasn't as innovative as Giuliani, but he was competent to a degree. And he maintained the city on crime, did some good things on school reform. And then the progressives in the city, they got lazy, sort of. They got used to all of this being great, and they fell for liberal politics. And the unions and limousine liberals teamed up and put Bill de Blasio in office, and he has run like a classic progressive. And, you know, this is exactly what the Democratic Party in Washington is now demanding, what you're seeing from progressives across the country. And so the city's a really good example of how bad things could get under that kind of leadership. And, you know, Bill de Blasio, he put regulations out that crushed small businesses. He reversed a lot of the gains of charter schools. The city's in a financial crisis after huge payoffs for public unions. Crime is a mess. We had 505 people shot in New York through May 9th, which was the highest year to date in terms of numbers in a decade. And, you know, add to this the city's problem. It was one of the COVID epicenters. Some 600,000 businesses have collapsed. There's a homeless problem. There's a million kids in a public school system that was already failing, but still has no plan even now for how it's going to work its classes in the fall. So this is really high stakes. And it's going to be fascinating to see who New Yorkers choose in the end and whether or not it is a rejection of that de Blasio governance.
And Bill, you mentioned that crime is the biggest issue for a lot of voters. In that New York Post poll from last week that I was citing, 29% said they were most concerned about crime or safety. Far and away, the highest subject name. The next highest was housing at only 11%, then jobs in the economy at 8%, and then a whole bunch of other issues in single digits. But it's interesting. I mean, if Eric Adams, who is leading the polls right now, if he is the winner, I mean, that would be quite a swing, Bill, from the de Blasio days to the city being led by a former cop.
Yeah, well, you remember, as Kim said, a lot of New Yorkers take it for granted. I mean, I'm from the area. I remember New York when it was the Wild West in the 70s and the 80s and so forth, you know, when the subways were just covered with graffiti. You didn't want to be on them after, you know, 10 o'clock at night and so forth. And when the public spaces were just inhospitable, Penn Station, different parks and so forth. And New York succeeded. You know, when Bill de Blasio took over as mayor, New York was the safest big city in America. And Kim mentioned Rudy driving the crime down, which he did to his great credit. And then Mayor Bloomberg drove it down to even further levels, you know, a lot of smart policing and so forth. But this was always unpopular with the left, with the New York Civil Liberties Union and so forth. And they were always looking over their shoulder. And when Bill de Blasio came in, he came in with an anti-cop agenda, which he kind of muted when he appointed Bill Bratton as police commissioner. And after two police officers were assassinated while sitting in their car, and then he kind of muted it. But he was one of the first with the anti-cop agenda. What's interesting is that after Eric Adams, who clearly is, he's the first choice of people that say crime is their biggest issue. He's the first choice. But the second choice overall seems to be Maya Williams, who's wants to take another $1 billion away from the police. So New York is not unified on these issues. They've done it before. We're not back at the levels in the 70s and 80s and even early 90s, but the path is going down in that direction. It's not going into improvement. So these ideas have consequences. You know, a lot of people that were wrecking property and so forth were never charged in New York. We had bail, quote, reform that basically let these people back out on the streets. A lot of these people are repeat offenders. The cops arrest them and then they're freed and they go out and they do it again. So it's going to be a daunting challenge for whomever takes over. And we're likely not to learn the results of this. I believe the law says that they're going to be counting ballots until June 28th on this. And with this complicated formula, we're probably not going to have a clear winner for, you know, at least a week.
But if it will be interesting if it's Adams, whether other candidates in other cities with similar crime increases in crime follow suit. And it looks like, Kim, it's both on the policy for him and on the rhetoric. So one thing that has been raised is these New York Police Department plainclothes anti-crime units, which were disbanded about a year ago. And Eric Adams says he wants to bring them back. And then on the rhetoric side, here's something that he said in an April magazine profile talking about the movement to defund the police. I'll just read a part of his quote. He says, when you start defunding, hey, the cop is no longer in your corner. That cop is no longer in your lobby. That cop is not standing outside when you leave your Broadway play. And I've never been to an event where the people were saying, we want less cops. Never. Unquote. And so, Kim, if that takes him to victory, it will be interesting to see how that affects the rhetoric in other cities.
Yeah, and on that rhetoric, another fun thing to watch on Eric Adams is that, you know, he will often go after, he has gone after Maya Wiley, who is the true de Blasio clone in this race. She's a hard left legal activist. And as Bill mentioned, she wants to cut the police force. But he'll point out that she lives in a pretty fancy Brooklyn house with her own private security. And so it's easy to be nonchalant about crime when you have your own armed guards around you. And so he's just been very, very open about his support for policing, the need to do something with the soaring violence in the city. It's a refreshing thing to hear, especially coming from an African-American man, and point that out too, given that New York has been the epicenter of a lot of the Black Lives Matters protests that have been going on this past year. And where for many people on the left, this has now become this test. You either have to be opposed to the police and critical of the police, or you're run out of the party. So it's been nice to see a man in longstanding on the Democratic left, the Brooklyn Borough President, come out and have this kind of conversation and be so unrelenting in his position on this.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. How about the issue of charter schools? That's another area where the de Blasio administration has taken criticism from conservatives. Bill, do you think there's any appetite among these candidates for a shift in approach toward charters?
I do. And first of all, you could not get more hostile to charters than New York City is now with Bill de Blasio. You know, there's a cap on the city charters that really needs to be lifted to let more of these schools come in and start to educate the children. I mean, if you look at the passage rates of the state tests, you know, who's proficient and above, and then you, first of all, the majority, I believe, of New York City school children in the public schools are below. But if you look at the numbers for Black and Latino children, it's far worse. There's no more than a quarter of them proficient or above in math and English. So it's a real crisis. Again, Eric Adams, I think, is for lifting the cap. That's a big deal because the teachers unions are very strong in New York. They helped put Bill de Blasio in. So that's hopeful. I'm personally skeptical about Eric Adams because I remember him when I was writing for the New York Post, and he did not distinguish himself as particularly anti-crime or good on school choice and so forth. He seemed to be a standard issue New York City politician. I don't know whether it's opportunism, but I do think it's real principle. He sees African-American communities devastated by crime, and he sees their kids not learning it through the public schools, you know, one of the greatest progressive indictments of this city. And I think he's at least saying the right things. The real question is, even if you get in there on a law and order thing, you have to take a lot of heat and a lot of organized opposition from judges, from, again, like the New York Civil Liberties Union and so forth. And we'll see if whoever gets in there. But again, to Kim's point, the Eric Adams faction is clearly, if you're voting for Eric Adams, you're voting for law and order and maybe charter schools. So let's do some things differently. You're willing to break with the progressive line. But, you know, the number two candidate is very progressive and could be a continuance of a Bill de Blasio. So that's a concern. And I think it's particularly a concern in the outcome with this ranked voting that that could propel her to the top.
Yeah, one more thought on charters. I think Eric Adams is not quite as friendly as you said, Bill. So maybe there's been a breaking development, but I was looking at a Politico article on this. And Catherine Garcia, the former New York City Sanitation Commissioner, She has said that she supports lifting the charter cap.
Right.
Adam seems to say that he wants to keep the cap, but he has talked about duplicating successful charters. Andrew Yang has also said he wants to keep the cap. But then there are some what he calls zombie charters, charters that were approved, but then the school closed or never opened. So he's open to is what he says is resurrecting essentially those charters and using them to create new charter schools. But still, Kim, I mean, those are three candidates at least talking about more charters to some degree, which it seems to me would at least be a serious shift in the city's stance.
Yeah, this has been surprising, a good surprising. If you look at the entire field of 13 candidates, the best person is a guy named Ray McGuire, who's a former Citigroup executive. He's not only been good on crime, but he's very good on education, outright supports more charters. As an outsider, he could probably do some real good for the city, but he's not doing well in the polls. So there's that. But yeah, when you look at this, as Bill said, standard issue New York politician field, you do have people that at least are not openly hostile to the charters. And, you know, on Catherine Garcia, she not only said, I mean, they're playing it safe, right? In that Catherine Garcia says that she would raise the charter cap, but she was very quick to also say that she would redirect $130 million in spending at the City Department of Education to public schools. You know, this is a way of trying to keep the unions still on side. But as Bill was saying, it would be hard to find someone that could be or a city more hostile to charters at the moment. So to your point, the fact that we have a few candidates that are at least open to doing something, I think is another decent sign for the city.
The other thing that will be interesting to watch is how this whole ranked choice business plays out. And Bill, this has been an electoral reform that a lot of progressives have pushed for wider adoption. And do you think this will be kind of an acid test for that? And we'll see if it works in a big city like New York.
Yes, I do. I mean, I was sort of opposed instinctively to the idea. I think it's just kind of cockamamie. I like the first past the post. But, you know, if you have eight candidates or 12 candidates or something splitting up the vote, you know, I could see why they did that. The previous rule was if you didn't get 40%, there'd be a runoff. So the reform is aimed at preventing runoffs from declaring a winner after the primaries. The question is it going to be a bizarre winner? Like, would the winner be one of the top two choices? Or would it be someone who got like a lot of second and third place choices? Then I think there'll be a lot of questions about, who's winning. It really complicates the formula, I think. And clearly in this race, it right now, it looks to me like it's hurting Eric Adams, whom, as I said, I've been skeptical about, but I do think he's the best hope for changing the system, as it now is. So we're going to find out. And, when they start counting the absentee, but I mean, I'm hoping it's not one of these giant messes that just, defeats the purpose by instead. Yeah, we don't have a runoff, but we wait 6 weeks for an outcome.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, it makes it very hard to poll and quite unpredictable. I mean, there's four candidates below Andrew Yang, including Ray McGuire, who you mentioned, Kim, and they have all single digits. But if you add them all together, they come up to 15% of people's first choices. And so if all those voters are going to be redistributed if they rank second or third or fourth choices. And so one of the questions here is, are you going to end up with somebody who may be the third or fourth choice, first choice of most New Yorkers? And that's the person who ends up being the mayor.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear for anyone listening to this, it isn't entirely certain about how ranked choice voting works. And by the way, you can be forgiven if you don't get it because it actually is quite complex. But, everyone goes out, lists their choices in order, and then counting proceeds basically in a number of rounds. And so in the first round, the candidate who has the fewest first choice votes is just eliminated. And then for those voters who rank that candidate first, their second choice becomes their first choice. And then you have a second round and you eliminate somebody again. The problem with this, and I think this is what you're highlighting, Kyle, is that it has the potential to lead to some really weird and bizarre outcomes. You know, for example, if you had a three candidate race, it's possible that if all the supporters of candidate A listed him first, he would lose in the second round. But, you know, if somebody strategically listed him third, he could win because a different candidate would be knocked out in the first round. And it just it leads to sort of impossible scenarios to figure out. My bigger concern with it is that, look, we are in an era where people have very little trust or falling trust in elections, and having a system that is even more difficult to navigate when that kind of trust in institutions is low, I think is a little bit worrisome. So I'll also be curious to see what the turnout is in this, and not just in this race, but the next time they do it, given how this plays out.
Yeah, one of the arguments for this ranked choice system is that it allegedly, this is the argument, that it makes politics less negative, because if you're the number one or the number two or the number three candidate, you don't want to make mad the supporters of the guy next in line, because when he gets eliminated, you want his supporters to also like you and to migrate over to your side. And so there was an interesting phenomena last week where Andrew Yang and Catherine Garcia went and they campaigned together, Bill. And here's what Yang told people. He said, rank me number one and then rank Catherine Garcia number two. And then it was unclear because Catherine Garcia was saying, I'm not co-endorsing. We are campaigning together. We are promoting ranked choice voting. And so it leads to some strange strategizing where some candidates are getting together to try to block a candidate who is ideologically on the other side. And we'll just have to see if the voters go along with that, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right about the incentives, because in ranked voting, you're not just concerned about your voters. You know, you're concerned about voters that are pretty strongly for someone else. And you're hoping that you can appeal to them to be the second choice. So it does create that incentive. I'm not sure that's such a great incentive. I'm not sure that people benefit from nicey-nicey campaigns where we don't get into it. It's kind of the same complaints about negative advertising. You know, there's a lot of things at stake in New York: education, crime, the future of the city. And I'd like to see people take the best shots at the candidates and say, don't vote for Bill, because if you do, this is what's going to happen. Or, you know, don't vote for Eric, because this is what's going to happen if you elect him. So I'm not sure the voters are, you know, it's a nicer tone, but I'm not sure the voters are really served by that. I think, you know, the question always is an election is that everyone's for, you know, mom and apple pie. Everyone's for fixing the schools, for having no crime, for attracting investment and so forth. But the how questions and the consequences of what they're proposing, that's where the rubber meets the road. And generally, the only people who are going to bring that out in a way that voters can understand are rival candidates. So again, I it might be nicer for the candidates. People don't kind of sling the mud the same way, but I'm not sure it's actually a help to voters trying to make tough decisions.
I'm also just not convinced that they don't sling the mud the same way. I mean, there are a lot of points in this campaign that you would say are less than high-minded. There's been a long-running argument, especially pushed by Andrew Yang, about whether Eric Adams actually secretly lives in New Jersey. Adams is saying that Yang and Garcia are campaigning together to prevent a person of color from becoming mayor. And then Andrew Yang responded by saying this: I would tell Eric Adams that I've been Asian my entire life. So I'm still not convinced that everyone is playing nicey nice, but we'll have to see. We'll have to see what happens today. It'll be interesting to watch the ranked choice system at work. And then finally, last week we talked about the Biden administration's move to put Alaskan Arctic land off limits for oil drilling. And a little update, as luck would have it, a day or two later, there was a similar move that got a slap down from a federal judge. And Kim, your column last week was on this under the headline, Mr. President, Meet the Law. So what's the story here?
Well, a federal judge in Louisiana blocked the Biden administration's executive order that imposed a moratorium on new oil and gas leases on federal lands. And this was a pretty big deal. It was issued on Mr. Biden's first day in office, and it was stunning if you thought about it. It basically claimed the authority to override several laws that we have that actually order the Department of the Interior to do these lease sales, and also just overriding years of procedure. Those who follow this know that we have these five-year plans, and they're very involved, where everything is laid out in terms of where the leases or potential sales may be, and then there are comment periods and environmental analyses. And it just overrode all of that. And it said, we're pausing this. But the attorney generals of 13 states, especially those that could be really hurt by this moratorium, quickly sued. And this judge, Terry Doughty, not only blocked the order, but issued a nationwide preliminary injunction saying that sales had to begin again immediately across the country. Conservative judges in particular, and I believe this was a judge that was nominated by Donald Trump and confirmed recently, they don't particularly like nationwide injunctions. They're discouraged, but he said this was such a big deal. It was the only way to handle it, especially because a lot of these leases cross territorial lines, and so for uniformity. And he kind of slapped down the Biden administration, saying this injunction was merited because the case had such a high chance of succeeding, and that the power to pause, he noted, lies solely with the Congress, not with the president.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch if there is a similar case brought on the Alaskan wildlife refuge moved by the Interior Department. And Bill, it strikes me that we are probably going to be seeing a lot of this over the next 3 or 4 years. And that's what happens when you have government by executive order. And the president has a pen and a phone, but there are a lot of laws that a lot of judges are empowered to enforce.
Yeah, maybe we should take the pens and phones away from a president if that's how they're going to use them. Look, I agree. And what it hints at is also how disruptive this is. You know, people make big investment decisions. People have jobs. People move to those jobs because a lot of them were good jobs. And, you know, with the stroke of a pen, it's over. So I don't know where the courts are going to come down, but I think it's going to be gummed up in the courts for quite a while as they try to sort it out.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.